On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We all know the change from clock-punching, seniority-building, gold-watch careers in the old economy to the job-hopping, no-strings, freestyle scramble of the new economy. In the 1990s, the new economy life was loudly celebrated for its speed and creativity and fluidity, for its boundlessness and freedom. But it wasn't long before the bestseller was asking, "Who moved my cheese?" And a lot of Americans were feeling breathless, unmoored, even useless. Now an old flag bearer of the new left is looking deeply into the quality of life emerging in the light-speed global economy. Up next on Point, sociologist Richard Sennett on the culture of the new capitalism. Joining me now from London, England, is Richard Sennett. He's professor of sociology at the London School of Economics. He's had a remarkable life and career, child of leftist radicals. He grew up in Chicago's Cabrini Green housing project. In the late 70s, he co-founded the New York Institute of the Humanities, a hothouse of ideas that included the likes of Susan Sontag, Edmund White, Joseph Brodsky, and Michel Foucault. He has spent his career studying how people relate to their workplace, to their government, and to their cities. His research resulted in many books, including three novels, his latest book, the new one, The Culture of the New Capitalism. Richard Sennett, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, hello. Good to have you.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Mr. Sennett.
Hello, Jack.
Richard Sennett, what a fascinating book for an old new left guy who's now looking around at the new economy. And as I read you, almost longing for the iron cage. What's up here? Are you nostalgic for old-style capitalism all of a sudden?
Not quite. You know, my generation thought that by taking apart big institutions, big bureaucracies, that we would create a kind of more communal face-to-face and local life. And what's happened is that we've sort of half got our wish that the new kind of capitalism are institutions light, but they haven't really created a kind of more communal life for people. And my book is an analysis of that. You know, it's more complicated than just wishing to go back for the old certainties. Mm-hmm. It's something happened that we still, I don't think, really understand very well, which is how the economy took this turn in such a way that people don't really get what they'd hope to get from particularly their working lives, their working institutions.
I wish you'd define your terms a little bit for us. We heard a lot in the 90s about the new economy, and it became associated with the internet boom and so on. Now you're writing about the new capitalism, maybe something slightly different. You say it's not the whole economy. Not everyone works here yet. But what is it? Who's in it? And what's it like to work there?
Well, the new economy is really composed of three parts. Part of it is globalization. Part of it is certainly technology. But the third part of it, and I think the one that affects most people's lives, has to do with the way in which our institutions are structured. There was an enormous change that occurred in the late 80s into the 90s in the way in which people thought about what institutions should look like. They should be lean. They should be highly centralized in terms of being able to change their activities on a dime. And most of all, they should be short-term. The whole frame of people's experience in institutions became more short-term orientated. And instead of, for instance, having a career doing something, working, going up and down a ladder.
Within one big corporation that went on and on in more or less the same form, the old
right.
style.
Right. IBM is a kind of great example of that. Up to 1993 it was, people had jobs for life. They pretty much knew where they go up or down, very clear. After 1993, it suddenly there's a big shake-up. IBM starts doing lots of different things. People don't know where they belong in the organization, and its whole time frame shifts to a much shorter horizon. And Tom, what I'm arguing in my book is this, that there are positive things to this shortening time frame. It means that people can be more agile and more flexible. But there are also very negative things about this kind of change in institution. It means that people don't really have a chance to think strategically about what they want to accomplish for themselves in the long term. They become prisoner of events. They have to navigate in a world often where surprise overrules their will. And if you're at the top of an organization like that, you can probably do pretty well. But for people in the middle, who are the people I've studied in this new economy, it's tougher. You don't have the resources, if suddenly the rug is pulled out of you, from under you, to keep going over and keep your balance. So my worry about this is that we've been celebrating kind of change. It's not just in business institutions. It's also in the way we run hospitals or schools.
And it's becoming the model for government reform, as you write. Lean, quick.
Lean, quick, theory. Short-term. I don't think this does ordinary people the same good that it does people at the top. And that's the culture I'm trying to understand in my book.
What kind of jobs are you writing about? What portion of let's say, American workers are residing in this new capitalism, light, lean, short-term? A fraction? Who?
A very small fraction, 8 to 12%. And people who are involved in real high-tech, financial services and urban services, which are the three areas we studied. The odd thing about this is that this slice of the economy, this new economy, this cutting edge, if you like, becomes a model for lots of institutions that it doesn't suit. I mean, do you really want to run a hospital as though it were an investment bank? That's the kind of problem we're facing. It's glamorous, makes lots of money for people at the top, and so we take it as a kind of model for more ordinary ways of running our affairs, and that's the trouble with it. Oftentimes, when we use the word reform in an institution, we mean stripping out middle layers of people in the institution. The institution losing its identity, doing all sorts of things, whatever suits the moment. That's not really a reform. That can be a deformation rather than a reformation. And that's the problem, I think.
Jack Beattie, Richard Sennett describes this as not just changing workplaces, but really changing people's selves and changing their relationships in directions he's clearly not altogether happy about.
Yes, above all, it puts a premium on people who can abandon the past, who can give up on the idea that they are vested in any way, or that their knowledge, their experience, entitles them to authority. That's a kind of weightless, gravityless workplace that puts the focus on talent, this amorphous potential that people are supposed to have, that again just derogates experience. And, reading this, I was struck with, we give up a lot for our economic dynamism, but our children, if this picture is right, if this small part of the economy grows, our children are going to give up even more. I mean, career stability, maybe even a career, the satisfaction of doing jobs meticulously and well, the confidence that comes from mastery, from competence displayed over time. All of that may be out the window for them. That is, if they're lucky to be doing anything at all. I mean, the most frightening chapter here is called The Specter of Uselessness. That with 300 million Indians coming into the job market, highly trained within the next decade, that's the population of the United States, and with technology, more and more of our children may have nothing to do. This is a scary idea.
Richard Sennett, is it really that gloomy? Is there not, in this new capitalism, new economy, kind of new man, new woman that emerges, that thrives on this fluidity, perhaps in the way their parents may have at one point thrived on stability.
Well, I think that's certainly true for people in the elite. I think what Jack Beatty is pointing you to is what happens if you're not one of the people who, you know, went to Harvard or to Princeton, and you don't have a kind of cushion of, you know, exceptional talent that's going to see you through. For more ordinary people like most of us, the kinds of ways in which we make meaning in our lives are by, you know, being good citizens, long-term service, being loyal to an organization, whether it's a business or a nonprofit activity like teaching. The idea of being a kind of constant entrepreneur is something that really is not, I think, a great way for most human beings to develop. And it's not that we longing for stability or certainty is what's the issue here. Mm. It's a kind of institutions that allow us to develop a life narrative that we can really shape for ourselves.
Richard Sennett, I wonder if you saw yourself on the streets of Paris in the last couple of months. Are you with the young French people saying, no, we don't want to be part of this global economy, we're losing too much here? Was that Richard Sennett there?
Half. I think they've woken up to the fact that they're really insecure, and their first impulse, these kids, was to look backward and to say, no. We want things to be as they've been in the past. And, you know, it's you can't blame them for them. These changes have been in the making for a long time, but it takes people a while to sort of understand what's happening and what to do about it. Most people's first impulse is to register the loss that they're having. I think eventually these kids are going to have to face the kind of solutions that have been tried in the Netherlands or in Nordic countries, where you have job sharing, where you don't work full-time, where you work half-time, and you create jobs by dividing them up in half. And the government tops up those salaries, not wonderfully, but enough for people to get along.
May I ask you on that point?
That's not a satisfying answer, but it's something that's more forward-looking than simply saying, no, we want security, we don't, you know, we don't want to be... We want things to go on as they've been.
But let me ask you about that. You know, the French demonstrators have been widely derided in the American media for just being out of touch.
Oh, really?
Absolutely, up and down, saying, look, this is a new day. It's a new economy. What are you going to do, hide in your shell or go out and compete? Why job share? Why not go out and compete and win new jobs and win new wealth and on you go?
Well, part of the problem with that is a structural one, that economies like the French or the German and increasingly the American can, as it were, do more with less. You can create a fairly rich society by using fewer and fewer workers. So the notion, you know, that everybody goes out and gets a job is a slightly... irrational, economically, slightly irrational kind of answer.
But we find meaning in work, in labor.
That's right. And that's why everybody has to do work. And that's why things like job sharing they're halfway measures. You know, they're to get people so they're doing something productive, that they're not on the dole. But it's a way of exploring ways of how it is in an economy that doesn't need all the people in a particular society to function well, to still include as many people as possible. I'm very surprised you tell me this, that this was seen as a kind of self-indulgent thing. These kids, they face terrible problems of unemployment. Unemployment is about 18 to 20% for college graduates.
But the criticism made is that it is that exactly because France hasn't come to grips with the new economy. The U.S., for all its faults, is described on this side of the pond as attempting to, and in that having a much lower unemployment rate and maybe still being in the game when the French, as seen, are choosing to sit on the bench.
Well, I don't think that's quite fair to them, and it's not quite accurate about the U.S. Overtraining is a big problem in the U.S. as well. If you talk to 21-year-olds about their confidence about finding jobs for which they're trained, they're not confident about it. We have numerically more work, but a lot of that work is fairly poor quality. And as more and more people get into the educational system, the things that they're learning in school are not things that they're then able to use when they get out into the work world. The issue about this is that well identified by Tom Friedman in his book, The World is Flat, I think that's the title.
Yes.
Which is that we used to think that the problems of unemployment were basically working class issues. And now with globalization, these are middle class problems because a lot of the specialized or skilled work that people used to do in the West is now being done for them elsewhere.
But, of course, Tom Friedman says go out and compete on that plane.
Yeah. Well, Tom Friedman has sort of more faith than I do, I think, that we can develop jobs for everybody that somehow, technology is going to produce a whole new world of work and so on. That's an argument one can have about the numbers. But Tom Friedman, I think, is like, not more gloomy, but I would say more realistic people, analysts of the work world, in understanding that this is a real challenge for Americans. It's not a challenge that's posed by Mexican day laborers struggling to, get across the border. Mm-hmm. It's a different kind of specter of uselessness, and it's more than simply the fact that computer code is written cheaper in India than it is in the U.S. The Indians have done a good job of that. These aren't inferior workers to us. We're in a world in which labor is scarce for the middle class.
And so dancing as fast as we can, but it's a changing dance floor here.
Right.
Richard Sennett, Jack, a lot of our listeners want to join this conversation. They're out there living with this. I want to begin to turn to them. Let me go to Kay in Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Kay, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
One of the things I've noticed is sort of a culture change. I mean, my parents were blue-collar, and despite somewhat unsatisfying jobs, they balanced that with some sort of quality of life and job security. My husband and I have both gone to college and graduate school. He now works as an investment banker, and there isn't any balance left. He frequently works 20-hour days are not uncommon. Ooh. He gets that's 6 or 7 days a week. He's asked, "Are you coming in on what day are you coming into the office this weekend?" There's never a time when he's unreachable through BlackBerry or whatnot, and if he's not, there's an issue there. And so I think that sort of the culture has changed as well. Even for white-collar workers, what we thought was the American dream of going beyond our parents and blue-collar jobs to go to white-collar jobs where we're supposed to have some comfort and some security and stability, and that isn't the case. And not to mention that the hours, the expectation without being paid by the hour, that you're going to be there at the beck and call of any time of day or night.
So, Kay, maybe you've got the cash from an investment banker spouse, but not the culture or lifestyle you were hoping for.
I mean, there isn't any balance whatsoever. So because you have an expertise in this field and you're trying to work in this field, but there isn't any balance whatsoever into your life and no recognition of that whatsoever, absolutely none. So I was joking with him last night that maybe the next labor movement would be white collar because there isn't any balance left in any whether it's blue collar or white collar now of what your life should have a balance to it between work and recreation, I guess, or family.
Kay, we hear it, and you put it well. Thank you for your call. Richard Sennett, that's just the jumping off point that where you're very much standing. I wish you'd take us a bit into your analysis of exactly what you see being lost in a more nuanced way here in this new realm that Kay describes.
Well, I think what Kay's described are two very different things. One is what it means to keep dancing in this kind of economy, which is that you submit much more to the workplace as a kind of total experience in your life in terms of time, mm-hmm. stress, and so on. The other issue about it, I think, is when she says maybe we need white-collar unions, points to another cultural factor that I tried to look at in some depth in my book. And that is why people take this as a kind of absolute inevitable regime to which they need totally to submit. Mm. Why don't we put pressure on employers to behave more responsibly to us as parents, for instance? Why don't we ask employers to organize themselves well so that we're constantly so that we're not constantly at their beck and call over crises? What's happened in this realm of the new economy is that people with power have ceased, I think, really understanding that they have responsibilities to the people who work for them. And the interviews I did with people in the middle of these organizations mm-hmm. came up with that again and again and again, that the employers don't deal with them as though the employers owe the employees something as human beings. And for middle-class people, that's a shock. It's the way bad working-class employers used to be. But it raises a kind of profound question. What kind of institutions can we make in which people are responsible to each other, which loyalty means something, in which commitment is more than just a slogan? And I think what Kate has described to you is a kind of world in which the employee is giving everything and all he or she is getting back is cash. Mm-hmm. And that's not enough for most people.
Jack, at the same time, Americans like to see themselves as people who rise to the challenge. This looks like the challenge. So you've got people attempting to rise to it and make the best of it. And it's been celebrated, you know, on the covers of our business magazines, the fortunes that come out of this, the companies that do compete successfully globally, widely celebrated. I mean, can we really embrace some alternate vision and still kind of have the American gung-ho thing going on?
Maybe not. The gung-ho thing in our history has been a source of strength, but also weakness. I mean, lighting out for the frontier, Americans in the 19th century escaped many of the challenges of the cities, of work, of class, of exploitation. The frontier, whether literal or whether, you know, the fresh page of the new workplace, always seems to offer that hope of,
right.
Well, we're going right. to begin it all again.
Start
but
over.
Of course, we're the yeah. same human beings with the same needs. And above all, the need for meaning is paramount in human life. We are meaning-creating creatures.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And when we work for institutions that do not allow us to do that, or that actively, in fact, say, listen, don't worry about really doing this well, just do it. Just get it done. Just send that computer code out onto the public. We don't have to make it real good. They'll tell us what we need to do, and we'll fix it. Well, you know, that corrupts people. That undermines this hunger that what I do is significant because I am significant. And what worries me about the new workplace is that it sort of hollows out this sort of strut of identity.
Yeah. In my book, Jack, I try to phrase that a little less elegantly as a notion that people have, the meaning that people really need is to feel that they're good craftsmen in what they do.
Mm.
If you take away that sense of being a good craftsman from someone, what remains is the stress, the hassle, sometimes in cash, but not much of a sense of accomplishment. And the problem with institutions that are very short-term is they don't give people enough time either to develop that sense of craftsmanship or to practice it well.
Now, let me just ask you about that. Who says? I mean, doesn't Kay's husband probably have pressure on to be a very excellent investment banker? Or that software writer, yes, sometimes it's put out and improved, you know, in new iterations, but it's not as though quality and demand for quality has been thrown to the wind, has it?
I'm not talking about quality. Mm-hmm. I'll give an example of what I mean. When I interviewed software programmers in Silicon Valley at the start of this project, these are very talented people, and they did very good work. But what they felt was that they didn't have a chance to sort of build on their skills. They were being constantly thrown from one project to the next by people who were building the companies in which they were working mm-hmm. for, and that their scientific understanding wasn't really developed by their work. I remember one guy saying to me, the only way to really get satisfaction in programming is to put on a pair of binoculars and just stare at the screen and tune everything else out. That's very hard to do when people are saying, okay, we're not going to do that project anymore, we're going to only take it halfway. And I would, from the interviews that I and my students have done of people working in the economy, I'd say this is a most prevalent feeling that people have, which is that this short time frame means that they don't get that sense of really developing what's inside themselves. That's a serious loss of meaning, I think. It's not that they're untalented. It's that the conditions aren't really fostering the development of their work.
And so a loss of that slow, patient investment in a career, and yet, as Jack says, a lot of people accept this as an inevitable piece of evolution, is it not?
What does it mean for something to be inevitable?
Yeah, that's a good question.
What does that mean? Who says it's inevitable?
Karl Marx, maybe. You quote him saying,
Karl Marx,
all that is solid melts into air.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the issue for us is, let me put the comment I made to you in another way. Why isn't work more of a political issue in the U.S.?
Buck is calling from Yemassee, South Carolina. Hi, Buck. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. What do you know?
I was just calling. I'm currently working in a blue-collar capacity right now, but when I was younger, I did sort of have the aspiration to be a computer video game programmer, so I've been kind of following that world, and I just sort of noticed, it seems a bit of a stretch in connection with your point, but the rise in popularity of these internet role-playing games where you create a character and then through just hard work and diligence, building hours and hours to developing this character, you know, you get a rank, you get a name, you mm-hmm. move up. It's almost, I've heard it jokingly referred to as a job, you know, and I'm wondering if people are searching for that kind of stability because, like one of your panelists said, it's sort of a necessity, an emotional need. If they're searching for that elsewhere in this sort of virtual world, creating a character that they get guaranteed rewards for putting in hard work and, you know, devoting time and investing emotionally into this.
Amazing. Virtual meaning through fictional online characters. Stick with us, Buck. Richard Sennett, what do you say to Buck?
Wow.
Wow.
I understand it in a way. I mean, you know, people want a project. Everybody needs a project, something that you can work at, you know. I hadn't thought of it in quite that way, but I understand the impulse.
Buck, do you feel, I don't know, do you do it? Do you create an online self of importance?
Well, I do dabble a bit.
Uh-huh.
You know, there are certain people who do devote, you know, way more time than I even have on my hands to developing these characters because there's sort of a guaranteed reward where even no matter how hard you work, if your company doesn't need you, they can still, you know, downsize you even if you've been there, you know, for years and drop you without a pension and so forth. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, in the game, as long as you play by the rules, you're going to get by if not get ahead.
Wow. Buck, thanks very much. Jack, what a picture. Meaning in an online, mask? And in life, maybe something less.
Isn't that something? If we didn't have art, we would die of life. Isn't that the...
right. Now, there's a subject to discuss.
Yeah.
I mean, but I think Buck brings up one you said something in passing that is quite important to me, and that's the notion that people need to feel useful in some way. And I think one of the big issues we've got to deal with is how to reward people for doing tasks, or make them recognize them for doing tasks that we sort of take for granted, but we don't recognize as not as economic. For instance, care of the elderly, doing community service. These are jobs, and yet we don't think about them as jobs, and we certainly don't pay people for taking care of their aged fathers or mothers.
Who would pay them for that job?
There are countries in which you are paid for that. If you in Denmark and
by
in,
the government,
you're providing a service that otherwise government would have to provide in an old age home. The point I'm making here is that if this specter of uselessness hangs over us in the kinds of things that we think about as meaningful work now, one way to diminish its psychological and emotional pull is by expanding the field of what we recognize as work. Feminists have often said this about housework, that housework is work, and should be taken as a kind of real labor. And I think that's an insight that really needs to be quite broadly applied to the to modern societies, advanced societies like our own. Mm. If somebody's got time on their hands, we can make them a useful member of the community rather than somebody nursing a grudge by putting them, you know, to work as buddies for young kids, or looking after the elderly, doing work in hospitals and so on. We've left this all to the kind of volunteer sector.
Yep.
And that may be the wrong way to think about it. It's great when people do volunteer, but maybe we should look at what volunteers do as something that's much closer to the world of, you know, of real work.
Call it a job and pay for it, and maybe build a path back to meaning right there. We've got a lot of people who want to join us. Let's turn to a bunch. Nancy's calling from Maynard, Massachusetts. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for this great discussion, and I like your Nietzsche quote about art and life. But anyhow,
yes.
I resonated with something back earlier in the discussion, and that is that one of my interests is the psychology of life on the streets and gangs and criminal behavior. And what I picked up on in your introduction was words like living by our wits, evaluating the short term over the long term. And this began to make me feel very uneasy. And I was reminded of characters like the Artful Dodger, created by Dickens, and that what we are really valuing is qualities that used to be considered criminal qualities. And I could elaborate on this, but maybe you'd like to pick up on that. If not, I can continue.
No, I think we've got the gist of it, and it's fascinating. Richard Sennett, are we all artful dodgers now to get ahead in this economy, or is that pluck?
Emotionally, I think I'm on Nancy's side on this, although rationally, I don't think it's necessarily criminal. But, you know, what's interesting about Dickens, for instance, is the notion for him that the artful dodger is somebody who's willing to abandon anything to get ahead. That's a kind of short-term thinking, if you like, in a way. And I think one of the things we need to do is think about with this culture is how much it's actually devaluing the investment we make in experience if we think, well, I'm going to have to give it up and do something else. I'm going to have to dodge a bit in order to survive. It's not criminal, but it's self-destructive.
And you say ultimately destructive of democracy, politically destructive.
Yeah, well, that's another whole other issue. I mean, there's a whole political side to to these changes. But it's a politics very difficult for us to understand. It isn't just a politics of minimum wage, although that's all important, or ensuring that people get proper benefits from jobs if they're working short-term. It's that there's a whole political psychology contained in this new economy, and that is that nothing really counts, that you're not responsible long-term for your actions.
So the metaphor bleeds into our political self-understanding.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, if I may say so, I think it's a problem that in the U.S. we're having particularly at the moment, that it's not just a Republican problem, I mean, it's a Democratic problem equally, that the notion of taking long-term responsibility for your actions is something that has become very foreign to the political landscape. The people are constantly leaving behind, as politicians, positions they've taken before, without people feeling that there's any betrayal in it. It's the acceptance of that kind of flexibility, that kind of lack of commitment, which seems to me to be one way in which the economy and the kind of culture of politics at a very profound level have become intertwined. I'm not just talking about Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Clinton was no more held accountable nor felt himself accountable, for instance, for making a mess out of reforming the healthcare system. We just don't think in those kinds of terms anymore, and I think that does us a terrible disservice as a polity.
I wholly hear that, and at the same time, I can't get away from a kind of smell of nostalgia about what you're saying that's hard to square with your own early days, new left guy. I mean, you quote Max Weber in here, the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism, saying the person who makes a life career in such an institution, a stable, old capitalism-style institution, lives in an iron cage. You say the vice of social capitalism was the iron cage of solidarity. The vice of the politics derived from the new capitalism is indifference. But wasn't that old iron cage something that you in your own youth fought against?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I guess the question is this, you know, when we remedy one social problem, do we create another, which is at its opposite extreme? And by the way, I have to say that I would never defend myself against the charge of nostalgia. Nostalgia has a very bad press in America.
But it's nostalgia for the very trappings of big capitalism that as a young man you seemed, for that matter, of big socialism that you were very much opposed to.
Absolutely. But what I'm saying to you is that I think what we've got to experiment with are ways of rebalancing and finding new ways of creating continuity and community in people's institutional lives within a situation in which that iron cage is no longer taken as a context. It's like going out of one extreme to the other, to saying, okay, I'm going to have no, I'm going to play totally by the book, mm-hmm. to saying there is no book, you know?
Yes.
That's not right. And I think what we've done is a kind of 180-degree turn, which is mindless, just to say, okay, you know, the iron cage is broken, so therefore there's no structure. And that to me doesn't seem to be really reform.
Let me turn to Crestview, Florida, and Jim. Hi, Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, I just want to make a comment. I've given up a really good IT job, okay? I mean, I was an IT analyst for a big company, corporation, and I worked a lot of years with them. I mean, I had pension plan, benefits, I had everything, but I was working 19-hour days, anytime they needed me, day or night, anywhere. It didn't matter. I was gone all the time. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know who my wife was anymore. It got to the point where I just looked at myself and just said, you know, I can't keep this up, man. You know, I took a job now. I work 5 hours a day. If I need some extra money, I'll go fix somebody's computer, make some money. I'm at home with my family. I'm happy, man. I don't have the big benefits. I have to pay for doctor's visits out of my pocket. But I'm going to tell you what, man, a little computer job on the side, I can go do it. but I'm at home. I feel good. I think I'm going to live forever now, you know?
Jim, we hope you do it, and we hear it. Your phone line's breaking up, and I'm sorry for it. But we hear your story. Let me get a couple more calls here. Margarita is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Margarita, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to ask what seems to me a simple question, which is, the iron cage, as you've been discussing, is broken, and there's this pressure for this agility among workers.
Yes.
Why can't we set up a system where there is a guarantee of access to health insurance and health care and retirement benefits so that you can be agile without being terrified that you're going to be abandoned because you're sick or because you're old or because some catastrophe in your life? It seems to me that if we set up the basic infrastructure for mobility, people will take advantage of that, and they can move with the economy as it changes and evolves, and we will be able to stay ahead of the curve. But right now, people are sort of locked into where they are because there are so few other options.
So acknowledge and facilitate the agility if we're going to ask it. Margarita, thanks for calling. Richard Sennett, you look to unions as perhaps an institution for doing that in a new way, not their traditional function exactly.
Right. Although I think what Margarita is saying is really important, that if you are going to, privilege short-term, flexible economic institutions, the balance to that, that's what I was thinking about before, the balance to that has to be that it isn't an all or nothing thing. If you lose your job, you lose your health benefits, etc. I tell you what I'm interested in about unions, and it's something that in Britain is being increasingly experimented with, and it might be a good thing for the U.S. as well. Unions here are beginning to work a little like theatrical booking agencies. You join a union, not because maybe a union just based in a locality rather than a union about a particular skill, and the union finds you short-term jobs if you're on 3 or 6 month contracts. Mm. It looks ahead to what will be available to you when that's over. It looks to create a kind of focus where you know other people like yourself who are begin to create networks of finding out about jobs and so on. It's less protecting workers' rights than it's creating a kind of network of workers and of work. And I think that's a very promising experiment for us in the States as well.
Union as agent, sort of riding along.
Yeah, it was a kind of, booking agency, as a kind of a temp employer, but which is one, which people form with each other rather than something like manpower.
Jack, the clock relentlessly moves on us here. We just got a minute. What are you taking away from Richard Sennett's latest look? He's had so many big ones in his lifetime, and this time a really deep one about where we stand now.
Well, I think it's both the prospect he draws is disturbing, but there's also, I think, some hope in there. And the hope is that we can make this work. That is to say, we
Absolutely.
Can't get away from globalization. It's just here, and we can, I suppose we can try through managing trade and so on, but we can't do anything about technology, really. We have to go with that. So then the question is, what do you do? How do you have a viable society? And I think Margarita really puts her finger on it. The condition of capitalism today requires a growth of the state, precisely in areas that capitalism can't deal with. In other words, the very condition of economic dynamism is social security, and social security meaning health security, too. That, I think, is the idea that has to be got across. We can be just as flexible, but we have to have an expanded public sector to give us the things work doesn't any longer.
Richard Sennett, we've got 15 seconds. Do you second the motion?
I second it fully, and I vote for it totally.
There we have it from London. Richard Sennett, wonderful having you with us. Thanks for your insights, and thanks for your time. Richard Sennett's new book is The Culture of the New Capitalism. And Jack Beatty, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.